Hey listeners, it's your producer Leah Faye here. I wanted to give you a quick warning that the intro conversation and the final conversation in this episode has a sound quality that admittedly isn't our best. I wanted to apologize for it. If you would like to skip ahead to the episode, it starts at about 5 minutes, but we decided to keep the conversation because we're pretty proud of what we talked about. So it's a smaller episode in total anyway, so we hope that you will listen to the whole thing, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with much better quality that we're proud of. Thanks so much. Hello and welcome to Finding Our Minds,
a podcast about having mind, knowing mind, and changing mind.
I am your producer, Leah Faye.
And I'm your host, Margaret Arndt Cadigan. Welcome.
Welcome. So what are we talking about in today's episode?
Last two episodes were heavy and deep about what is the unconscious. What I said, really, we have different ways of relating to experience. And so in this episode, I talk a little bit about, well, so what do we do then if knowing about how we relate to experience, what do we do in therapy to help people have a better relationship with experience to get better? Well, in therapy, it's an interesting thing. You can't ask the question about how do people get better without somebody jumping up immediately and saying, well, how do you know they're better? What was interesting is that I was thinking about this morning before you and I started talking. I've written this in an article before. There are two questions. How do you and your client know if your client is getting better or not? That's a legitimate question. But hidden under that question most of the time is, how can you prove to the insurance company that it's worth their money to pay for this therapy? Very different question.
Very different question that should have nothing to do with whether or not somebody receives care, in my opinion.
I agree. So today I talk about the kind of research that has been used to prove to insurance companies that it's worth their money to pay for their clients' therapy. And then I talk a little bit about how other people conceive of some research. And if we conceive of research that way, then the way that I propose, not just me, but other researchers and other analytic writers have suggested the way that analytic therapy works is quite legitimate and quite effective.
Yeah, I think this episode really challenges institutions. I think this is our whole podcast challenges a lot of institutions. But this one, I wrote in my notes, shots fired at academia today.
Yeah, there's that too.
Yeah. So, what do you think are some examples of failed forms of therapy that exist to make insurance companies happy?
I don't want to say that any of them are necessarily failed forms of therapy. I'm real clear that there are bad therapists and good therapists that use every single form of therapy that we know of. It's not the form of therapy. And this is what the common factors research demonstrates. I talk a little bit about this, that it's the relationship between the client and therapist that's the most robust predictor of whether or not your client is going to do better. So then the question is, what do we mean when we say relationship? And that's where my whole talk about mind-centered really becomes important to me. if my client and I are connected on the level of mind, that's a healing relationship.
That's fantastic. I don't actually have so much to talk about before the episode today. I think it really speaks for itself, and it's a nice, I think, tie-up over the last, as you said, kind of two heavier episodes. It's a little lighter, but you needed those two other heavy episodes to really understand what's going on when you start to emphasize this relationship. You know, I was having a conversation with somebody in my life who I think needs therapy recently, and they were hemming and hawing, and they were going, yeah, I do, but I really don't know what I would talk about. And I'm like, yeah, but you have things that you want to change. And this person went, yeah, but I don't know how to change them. And I went, well, that's what you go to therapy for.
Right. A therapist will help you figure that out.
Yeah.
You don't have to do this by yourself. And you know what? I think that that is a message that we can give people in every circumstance that's always helpful. You don't have to do this all by yourself.
You are not alone. There are people in this world who think that you are worthy of taking care of yourself and being taken care of.
Hear, hear.
Last episode, I really drilled down on the different ways we relate to experience. Any experience is possible because we're part of the infinite universal mind that holds every experience. But we can't reflect on most experience. This is because the ability to reflect on experience requires that we've shared it with another mind. If you can reflect on experience, you can symbolically represent it. Once you can symbolically represent it, as an image or in language or however you do that, you can begin to play around with it. You can elaborate on it. You can blend it with other reflected experiences. You can dissect it and take it apart, and so on. This gives you mental flexibility, which is the foundation of mental health. Today, we're going to look at how therapy can help you get there. But before we go there, let's look at how we know if specific ways of doing therapy are likely to work or not. Maybe you felt like I felt many decades ago. It was really painful to be me. My life was saturated with difficulty, and I felt anxious, depressed, and stuck. I went to therapy. It changed my life. Let me be clear. I did not leave therapy perfectly healthy and content. But through therapy, I was able to make and see different choices. Each choice opened up more choices, and with each good decision, my life improved. It felt better and better to be me. This set me on the path of my, fourth career. I became a therapist to help other people experience this transformation. In order to do so, I had to learn the mutative effects of therapy. That is, what is it that makes change happen? The more I conducted therapy, the more interesting the process became to me. Some people changed so much, and others barely at all. There were moments in therapy that seemed to crackle with potential. The whole process of therapy became more and more mysterious to me, which is the opposite of what usually happens when we do something for a sustained period of time. Now, I'm an avid reader, so I read about every form of therapy out there. I studied the theories and the techniques to try to figure out how I could help a more diverse group of people find their ways out of suffering. As a licensed therapist, I have to take continuing education. I attended trainings in all the therapies. I finally decided that maybe if I got a PhD, I'd have enough knowledge. Maybe there I could find the key that would unlock well-being for everyone. What I learned was that I was not, by a long shot, the only person who sought this prize. Different people have looked at this question from many different points of view. Some people thought that whether or not therapy worked was due to the techniques that are associated with a brand of therapy. Different brands of therapy were believed to be superior to all others because of the way that the techniques associated with that brand were delivered. And oh boy, my students love techniques. They're concrete. They give you the sense that you're doing something and that you know what you're doing. So, people wanted to prove that techniques associated with different forms of therapy were good. Let's take cognitive behavioral therapy, for example. Researchers decided to set up side-by-side comparisons of CBT and other forms of therapy. In order to do this, they had to make sure that everybody who got CBT were all getting the same exact thing. It's like a drug trial. You want to make sure that everybody who gets the experimental drug gets the same dose of exactly the same chemical compound. How do you do that with therapy? If it's the techniques associated with a brand that causes change, then you write down very carefully what the person delivering the therapy should do. That is, you create a manual that tells you exactly what to do and exactly the order in which you do it. This experimental design assumes that Yolanda and Johan are going to deliver those techniques exactly like each other. Those two humans are perfectly interchangeable. And the way that Yolanda delivers the techniques to Dale will be exactly like the way she'll deliver them to Ray. And, by the way, the only aspect of the clients that's taken into account is their psychological symptoms. Now, in order to control for the variable symptoms, the researchers pick only research subjects who have a mild to moderate presentation and only one mental health diagnosis. Did you notice that the target of change is symptoms of diagnoses? The assumption behind this research is that therapy exists to reduce the frequency, intensity, and duration of symptoms of a mental illness, which are further defined as the diagnoses that exist either in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders or the International Classification of Disorders. A hidden assumption here is that the mind operates exactly like the body does. That is, the mind is like matter to the degree that it can be measured. You may also note that there's an underlying assumption that it can be separated into parts. The experience of each different symptom and each different diagnosis could somehow be targeted separately. Now, this form of research is highly prized in academia. There are a few reasons for this. On one level, the research closely follows the scientific method. There's a hypothesis in which you have a dependent and an independent variable. These variables are easily converted into numbers you get from measuring something. You identify where and how you're going to collect your data. You make sure you control for extraneous variables. Once you have your data, you choose the right statistical method to see if something statistically significant increased or decreased as a result of the experimental procedure. This, as I have discussed previously, has long been considered the only legitimate way to know about the world. It assumes that everything is measurable, reducible to numbers. This, in turn, assumes that everything worth researching is material. It has physical properties that can be counted. Again, the underlying assumption is that experiences, or what it's like to be who you are and have lived the life that you live, can be understood through the same methods we use to know the body. This kind of research is also valuable for people who wish to become professors. If you can get grants from the National Institute for Mental Health and do good scientifically sound research, you can do that research fast. You can do the research and write up your results in a year or so. This means that you keep applying for grants and you keep getting publications in journals that are considered to be impressive. That means that they only publish good scientifically sound research that yields the results the editorial board wants you to get. So you get tenured and promoted. If you keep at it, you get promoted again. You're a full professor. How cool is that? I learned this way of looking at therapy when I was learning how to be a therapist. It immediately seemed wrong to me. It didn't square at all with my own experience of therapy. But I kept my mouth shut because what do I know? Fortunately, people who know a lot more than me screamed their objections to this way of understanding therapy. The hackneyed phrase, "Much scholarly ink has been spilled debating the value of so-called evidence-based practice," appeared in a lot of articles. But those articles were largely published in journals that were not the favorites at universities. These critics pointed out that no evidence for effectiveness is not the same as evidence of ineffectiveness. Example, at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, experts were telling us not to wear masks because there was no evidence that they prevented disease. They didn't have evidence that masks were ineffective. They just didn't have evidence that they were effective. Turns out, once they got some evidence, reasonable people started wearing masks. Turns out, once there was evidence for lots of different forms of therapy, the evidence was largely ignored or dismissed. Therapies that were not evidence-based quickly became so. People who believed in those forms of therapy did the kind of research that was required of evidence-based practice with really interesting results. First, it turned out that all of the bona fide therapies showed pretty equal effectiveness. A bona fide therapy is defined as a form of therapy that has a well-developed theoretical base, a clear rationale for its methods, and is delivered by an actual trained therapist. Second, it turned out that all of the evidence that these researchers produced was largely ignored or dismissed by people who didn't like that form of therapy. I'm mostly talking about psychoanalytic psychotherapy here. It is an evidence-based practice. Go to Jonathan Shedler's website. But you probably didn't know that it's an evidence-based practice because your Psych 101 professor told you that it's not. Another response to the EBP movement was to design a different kind of research. As scientifically sound as the research design of EBP may be, it has some serious methodological flaws. For example, in head-to-head comparisons, one form of therapy was delivered by someone who believed in that form of therapy and was well-trained in using it, and the other was delivered by someone who believed in the first form of therapy and was well-trained in it. Another issue is that in real-life clinical circumstances, practically no one has a mild presentation of a single diagnosis, like the folks who were the subjects in the studies that tried to compare brands of therapies. Another problem? Follow-up studies were short. When long-term effectiveness is studied, it turns out that some forms of therapy begin to be less and less effective. At 5 years post-treatment, some forms of therapy seem to wear off almost completely. The list goes on. So what some researchers did was designed process research. EBP is based on outcome research. Process research asks the question, what actually goes on in real-life therapy versus in experimental conditions? Turns out something called common factors are more important than techniques. Common factors are things that happen in all good therapy. Here's an important point about good therapy. For every single form of therapy out there, there are therapists whose clients get better and therapists whose clients don't. It's not the form of therapy that matters. It's the way the client and the therapist fit. Research shows that the most robust common factor in successful therapy is the therapeutic alliance. The therapeutic alliance is three things. First, the therapist and the client agree on the goal of treatment. By the way, it may not be a symptom or a diagnosis. It can be something like a more meaningful life or better relationships or to feel better about yourself. The second part of the therapeutic alliance is agreement on the things you're willing to do to achieve those goals. Some people don't want to do homework for therapy. Some people don't want to talk about their childhood. If your therapist is trying to get you to do something you don't want to do, you're not going to get better. Third, the therapist and the client have to like each other. The client especially has to feel that their therapist understands them and likes them. Bottom line, it's the relationship between the client and the therapist that underlies change in therapy. Okay, that just opens up a lot more questions. I need to know more about this relationship. What's it based on? How do you achieve it? There's a lot of literature out there that addresses these questions. Sometimes it addresses them head on, and sometimes you have to tilt your head and squint a little bit to see how different theories and research findings address how we create a good therapeutic relationship. As you may have figured out if you've followed this podcast, I'm among those therapists who believe that infant development research can help us understand how to create a good therapeutic relationship. I'm not suggesting that clients are like babies and therapists are like parents. I'm saying this. Development is change, hopefully toward greater complexity and integration. If we look at how the human mind develops, we can see certain circumstances that support mental change in a direction that leads to a life in which it feels good to be me, and other circumstances lead to a life in which it does not feel good to be me. What it's like to be me, to be around other people, what it's like to be alive, can be painful. The mind seems to get stuck on suffering. So developmental research can show us some ways to help people change their minds in the direction of a better quality of life. Now my question has shifted. What about therapy helps people have better lives has morphed to how do we help people change their minds? How do we help them get unstuck from endless experiences of unbearable qualia? I've found three answers. First, we help our clients see those painful patterns that they keep repeating. We identify the pattern. This often requires that we help them figure out when the pattern began to coalesce and how it got strengthened. What experiences created this way of being in the world, and how is the client maintaining those patterns? We help them see how they now apply that old pattern to the way they perceive and interpret experiences, and thus lock those patterns in place. We call this insight or deconstruction. Second, we relate to our clients in a way that's different from what they expect, from what they have experienced repeatedly in their lives. That is, we work to break that old pattern. This isn't easy because we all continually pull others into our sets of expectations. A good therapist sees the pull and finds caring ways to resist it. We call this a corrective emotional experience in therapy jargon. Third, we help our clients to open their minds, to bring greater complexity, coherence, and integration to their mind through the connection of minds. We don't force our mind on the client. We don't blow their minds open. We offer a possibility. If and when our clients are ready to accept that offer, the connection of minds stretches both minds. Hopefully, in the area that is keeping pain locked in place for the client, the therapist's mind is more complex, more open, more flexible. If so, the connection helps to stretch the client's mind and give them greater flexibility. One psychoanalyst and infant researcher, Edward Tronick, has called this mutative sharing of minds dyadically expanded consciousness. This is all by way of demonstrating that my approach to therapy is not aimed at reducing the frequency, intensity, or duration of symptoms of mental illness diagnoses. I want to help clients open up pathways to make better choices, which lead to better choices, which culminates in a better quality of life. In other words, we help people change their minds. Is this an evidence-based practice? Given that psychodynamic therapy is evidence-based, and the way I do therapy is firmly planted in psychodynamic theory and practice, it's evidence-based. Given that it's firmly based on infant and common factors research, it's evidence-based. So yes, it's an EBP. But more importantly, can it help? So far, so good. Today, we looked at different ways that researchers have attempted to learn how to help people ease mental suffering. If you think that the only thing that's real is something with physical properties, and the only legitimate way to know the truth about the world is to measure things, then you're in real trouble when you're trying to learn about something that's not physical. On a more granular level, the way we weave these processes into a session is by engaging in what I've come to call intuitive inquiry. This is a way of interacting with a client where we use our intuition. We tune into their experience to determine on what precisely we will be focusing on, what we will do, what we will say next. If you'd like to learn more about intuitive inquiry, let us know on the Finding Our Minds Facebook page or by emailing us at findingourminds@gmail.com. Or you can wait a little while longer until my new book comes out, Intuition in Therapy Practice, A Mind-Centered Depth Approach to Healing, which will be out in a few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's a great place to say that I think we're going to start releasing some mindfulness exercises.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. We have a couple more episodes left. I think we're going to go to 11. So this is episode 9. 10 will be our penultimate. Then we're going to take a little break for a bit and, you know, release some smaller content mindfulness exercise episodes. So if you have any suggestions for things you would like meditations on, feel free to email us again, findingourminds@gmail.com, or join our Facebook group, Finding Our Minds podcast. We're having tons of cool conversations over there. Join us.
Yes. There are some very interesting conversations. One of the things that's interesting that's happening is that people are also accessing both of us directly rather than talking through the Facebook group or emailing us. And that's fine. I welcome that as well. I understand why some people might not want to be public with some of their questions and comments, and I appreciate that. But I have really found it very helpful for this podcast when people have reflections, thoughts, questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We welcome them. I don't check my Facebook DMs so much, though. So if you want to get in contact with me, I do check the email address. So, but if you want to write in anonymously, please, please use that email address. And I promise never, say your name on the podcast if you don't want me to, but DMing me on Facebook is a very bad way to get in touch with me. I'm on the platform less and less personally. I really only go for the groups that I'm in, actually. I'm in a lot of Facebook groups and moderate a lot of Facebook groups. I really love those communities, but my personal Facebook is not as active.
Okay. Thank you. Good. Thank you.
Yeah. So check us out. And I will plug one more thing since it is, you know, we are wrapping up and we're in our last three episodes here. It would be really great if you told a friend about the podcast, just telling one person. Word of mouth is the best way to get a podcast out there, and especially a little podcast like us. We could really use a recommendation here or there. So tell a friend that you think might be into it.
I want to echo, please tell a friend, because the more people who listen to our podcast, the more likely we are to get really interesting guests to come and speak to us and speak with us and engage in interviews with us for our next season. We're really looking forward to having some interesting interviews. So please make this grow.
Yes, please help us grow. And you can do that by listening to our next episode, which will be on May 23rd. Please go subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify if you would like to see us on a different platform, or if you would like to join the conversation, email us at findingourminds@gmail.com, findourminds@gmail.com, or join our Facebook group, Finding Our Minds Podcast. Your host is Dr. Margaret Arndt Cadigan, clinical social worker, associate professor at East Carolina University, and published author. Her next book, titled Intuition in Therapy Practice, A Mind-Centered Depth Approach to Healing, is being published by Rutledge and will be available this summer wherever books are sold. I'm Leah Fay, your producer. You can find me on Instagram at BossWitchLaFay, and I am launching my blog at the end of this month, BossWitchLaFay, so you can check that out. Our associate producer is Lindsay Price, technical director David Cadigan, who is working hard on our sound quality issue. Artwork, Ray Gonzalez, and music by Anton Ashmere.